And we are back with episode 830. That's right, 830 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Oh, this is Gary from Jacksonville. We get to talk about shows this week, right, John?
Yeah, shows. Somehow plural.
I guess I should have went with single. But yeah.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of shows to talk about this week. So we're going to be probably dominating this conversation with one in particular. I wonder if you can guess which one that is.
Outlander? Sorry.
No.
Okay.
Missed it by that much.
Geez, so close.
Yeah. Really, there's only three shows that are on the list all over the last 2 weeks. So, yeah, we'll cover this as best we can and kind of give you, hopefully, enough content to satisfy your appetites. But, before we do any of that, Gary, why don't you go ahead and give a disclaimer of some kind?
Yes, we'll be discussing one or more shows this episode, and when we do, we will not hold back with show discussion. We will say who lives, who dies, and why we liked it or are happy they are dead or mourn their loss. There also might be plot points and twists, which we will also reveal just because we liked them so much and we want to talk them out with each other. So if you don't want to be spoiled, you might want to hold off listening. If not, hey, pull up a chair and enjoy.
That's right. So we are going to go ahead, and I think we'll start off real quick with the shows, the other shows that are not quite as controversial. I'm going to go ahead and start with Fear the Walking Dead. There were two episodes, season 3, episode 11, La Serpiente, and season 3, episode 12, Brother's Keeper. Well, the first episode, I have to say, was pretty average to me. I think that it kind of took a step backward, unfortunately, from what was a pretty good mid-season premiere. Just didn't seem like there was a whole lot happening. It seemed like they were dialing back Maddie as far as the strong points in her character. And, giving way too much over to Strand in this particular case. And, while it's nice that everybody's getting back together, it seems like the story kind of hit a little bit of a snag there. Thankfully, in the next episode, Brother's Keeper, which was, I think, happening pretty much concurrently with the previous episode, things definitely started to heat up. The ranch is preparing for this massive herd coming their way. And in fact, I think this is a bigger herd of zombies and walkers than we have seen even on the original show. I think this is huge, maybe as big as the one that they dealt with at the beginning of the season a couple seasons ago on The Walking Dead. So they're obviously handling it a completely different way, with a lot less preparation. And the danger is real, so to speak, and it was kind of nice to see things fall apart, see people have to deal with that kind of situation, and just the fact that it essentially came out of nowhere, as far as I could tell, because it really didn't come up as something looming on the horizon. I think it kind of snuck up on them, which is actually a really interesting way for them to have handled things. So it was kind of nice to see them kind of bounce back from what I thought was a bit of a step in the wrong direction again. And things are always more exciting when people are dying on these shows. Yeah.
Well, that is part of, the genre, of course, where nobody's safe. So that's what...
Exactly. Now, also during these 2 weeks, we had a couple episodes of The Last Ship. Season 4, Episode 6, Tempest, and Season 4, Episode 7, Feast. And it's continuing to run somewhere between average and above average. The first episode I gave an 8, the second one a 7.5. It's always fun to see Peter Weller chewing the scenery. And I swear, the older he gets, the more he digs in. He is a joy to watch on screen, I swear. But then we also have the fact that they are so obviously cribbing from the Odyssey. It's so obvious that they try to lampshade it by having members of the crew actually reading the Odyssey.
Oh, jeez.
And when you get to that point, there's just a level of ridiculousness that you go, you can't help but roll your eyes. It's like, guys, we know that's the inspirational material. You don't have to keep beating us over the head with it. I like the fact, however, that there are some twists and turns as we go through this season. I don't think this is going to be the best season of the show by any means. I think it's actually going to turn out to be the weakest when all is said and done. But I think it's still entertaining enough, especially when there is literally almost nothing else on the air right now.
What an interesting idea.
Well, I'll say this, though. I mean, if you want a comparison, this is a show that is, a bit above average right now, even in its struggling season. But... I'd say that The Orville is a much more entertaining show than this right now. Hmm. So that's kind of puts things in perspective. It's not on our list of official shows because I think that it'll kind of fall into whenever we get around to watching it when the major hit comes in a couple of weeks. But no, if that was a summer show, it would have probably been up in our higher ranks, in my opinion. Now that brings us, especially since I kind of mentioned Star Trek, to the other show that was running. And this would have been the long-awaited premiere of Star Trek Discovery, the first two episodes. Episode one was The Vulcan Hello, and the second one was Battle at the Binary Stars. Now, boy, do we have some interesting opinions on this one. I was more favorable than either you or Edmund. Gary, why don't you give me your opinion of these episodes as a long-standing, very vocal Star Trek.
There's so many different ways I could go about this. I've been questioning myself on which direction to go. However, in fairness to everyone, I try to objectively observe the film.
Before you start, I just want to say, I actually agree with what you just said there with the film. Because this felt like a self-contained movie in many respects.
Well, if you got to see the second half of it, John. Oh, sorry.
That's a completely different issue.
Yes, it is, but it is still a valid one. But anyway, yeah. I will step back from that for a moment. I will save that for later. I thought they did a very good of introducing Michael Burnham. As a character, and gave us a reasonable amount of background for her. Also established a really close connection with Captain Georgiou? Captain Flip, how about that?
Yeah, there you go.
They gave us a nice view of the small ship as well. I felt that she was definitely strong into her Vulcan training or upbringing, and was sort of stiff and somewhat by the book, but you could sense a little bit of passion within her as well. We were introduced to Lieutenant Saru, which is a new alien that we hadn't seen before. I even went back to the motion picture where they introduced a bunch of different aliens, and I really didn't see anybody that looked like him either. So I will say I think it's definitely a new race, but I did try to check where I could. And we got a general introduction. Well, not let me rephrase that. A very scant introduction to the rest of the crew. We really didn't get much of a focus on them. And we got to see a cute little gimmick with a Delta symbol in the sand, which didn't make much sense to me. That being said, they felt like they were trying very hard to portray the universe. It was, look here, this is, look here, that is. Oh, do you see this? And I felt they were making more of an effort to point things out than to tell the story at times. And I felt this, it pulled me out of the story a little bit as they would sort of focus on certain things. And then we get to our protagonists, which were the Klingons. And
antagonists. Well, before we go there, I just want to say that I agree with you. There were moments where it really felt like the storytelling was kind of effortless, and then there were moments that felt like they were trying so hard to say, see, look what we did there, that it was just really just a bit awkward.
And just as a little side note, the cost for the number of lens flares they had in the first episode are estimated by special effects people at over $32,000.
And Abrams had nothing to do with it.
Yes, see? I know. Yes, but they said they rated what it cost to do something like that. And they're like, yeah, they dropped over $30,000 in lens flares. I was like, oh, that's nice. No wonder they cost $8 million to make these things. Anyway, back to the story. I didn't mind the look of the new Klingons. Yes, it's a departure from what it was before, but heck, I had a heck of a departure with the original motion picture that came out. So I can buy that in stride. And yes, they look a little bit different, and I don't feel that it's necessarily that the look is not very original. I've seen similar designs in other places before, and it just seemed I don't really feel they made an effort to make them extremely different. I think they are reasonably in keeping with what we thought was a Klingon. However, the way that the Klingons were talking, and I know this was intentional, but at the same time, I felt like they had like bad prosthetic teeth in their mouth, or they had stones in it, and you could not make out what they were saying. I know they did this intentionally to make them appear more alien or fierce or something along those lines. But at the same time, you know, at some point you have to suspend some, you have to allow for some disbelief to be there. And the fact that it felt like he could not talk without his teeth hitting each other in a way that he didn't mean them to, was very off-putting and took me out of the scene every time the guy was trying to make what I felt would have been a very dramatic speech if he wasn't tripping over his dental appliances. And I didn't care for that aspect of it. I thought the actual words coming out were really good. The scene was good, but it just was so clumsily delivered with the dental appliances, trying to, I guess, be that sort of more rough, monstrous type of aspect appearing, that it was over the top. It went a little too far for me. That being said, I thought the Klingon presentation was great. I enjoyed the ship looked a little odd, but I will take that in stride. I know they swear up and down on a stack of you know, Gene Roddenberry Bibles that this is an extension of the original universe, but they're so much different. I find that hard to accept as a fan, but I don't mind that. I can look at it as a sort of offshoot or something like that. I don't need it to be the prime universe. And that being said, the ship was very intriguing. It was something different than anything I'd really seen before in Trek. The odd covering of all their dead over the thing was a very intimidating, almost Firefly Reaver-like thing for me, and I enjoyed it. I thought it worked. It was creative and different, and I liked that as well. This whole idea of uniting the different clans into, you know, a single unifying force was a really nice thing. It never really got touched on too much. It was more the houses breaking up rather than coming together is what we've dealt with Next Generation. So that was a reverse on a premise, which I thought came across very well. And I enjoyed their, I don't know what it was, irony, I guess, maybe, of as they talked about, oh, watch the Federation talk about coming in peace, yet they're killing us and shooting at us, and sure enough, they do. So I thought that was a nice sort of look from the other side at the benevolent Federation. And so overall, the first show we could stop at was good as a whole for a storyline. I have a whole bunch of issues that we could spend with as a secondary show talking about. But as I said, I do want to be positive. This was very much a pilot that was not only rushed but delayed, then rushed again. So I expected it to have a lot of warts and ugly things about it. And overall, with a few exceptions, I think they pulled off a good science fiction show.
So, yeah, I think that bears getting into just a little bit more.
The
whole idea of where this falls in continuity and where the issues are, because as I was watching,
yes,
I didn't necessarily mind some of the things. I thought that, the whole thing with Michael being ingrained in the Vulcan way was maybe a little bit of a departure, but you could kind of accept it for what it was. Especially given the fact that, Sarek is the ambassador, it would make sense for something like that to happen.
And even though, and they tease Spock incessantly about being a half breed, imagine what they did to her.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I really do kind of stumble over some of the stuff with the Klingons. I didn't notice the thing with the difficulty with Klingon diction, shall we say? But it was strange that the words that were being said seemed so obviously connected to Star Trek continuity, and yet there were aspects that didn't quite add up to me. It seemed like things were either happening way too early in the timeline, or they were events that were so big that they should have been referenced previously. So it just kind of fit in a very strange place to me, and I kept wondering again, like, well, this is after Enterprise, yet there's no definitive link to that in terms of the Klingons then and the Klingons here. And like you said, you can kind of, if you kind of squint a little and maybe hit your head a few times, think that, okay, it doesn't look that different, but it just seems kind of like unnecessarily oblique. Is that the word I'm looking for? Like, we just changed a few things just for the sake of changing a few things. It's like,
yes, exactly. Yeah. And if I want to start getting on that horse just a little bit, yes. And, don't get me wrong, I don't think a core Star Trek audience will ever generate huge numbers on a regular basis. So they got to bring in a regular – geez, do I want to say regular people? Yes, I will. I'll say regular people into watching these shows. And Next Generation did it well. Deep Space Nine to some extent, and Voyager did it very well to bring in people who weren't diehard Star Trek fans. They scooped up that audience, and that got them the ratings to stay on the air for 7+ seasons. But so they need to appeal to an average viewer, not just an uber Star Trek person. I would say even with this whole paywall, you know, CBS needs to attract regular viewers to who want to watch these shows. And so you have to change things. Like, as we say before, oh, look at this cute thing I did. Oh, look, I did this. Oh, look, I did that. That's all fan service. That is not going to get you a new viewer who hasn't watched Star Trek before.
And frankly, I mean, the Klingons as they are here are a huge barrier to that.
As I said, I found them, you know, I'll skip the sort of jokes about Klingon pronunciation, but honestly, it's like their teeth were grinding through the whole thing to make them seem menacing. And you never actually, other than a guy spouting grandiose speeches, I still never felt like I knew anything about him. Maybe the albino guy I sort of had a little bit more of a sense of Klingon, but that was about it. And the rest, even though he's this grand guy, Toombra or something, that who's, you know, prophesized to, you know, bring back the houses of Kalis or whatever. Even as a Star Trek fan, I didn't care. And wow, he's intimidating, but that's all I knew about the guy. I don't understand his motivations or why he's doing this, or at least if they tried to tell me, it didn't get through. And so if it doesn't get through to me, somebody that can actually understand Klingon and, you know, cares about the Empire in some respects, how the heck is a regular person going to care about it? They're just not.
And never mind necessarily that part, even. Half the episode was in subtitles. Now, that's fine for those of us who actually want to know what the Klingons are saying in detail.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I was...
Okay, and I still question some of that. Anyway, but...
yes, because it doesn't quite track. But...
And I was reading an article by a producer who suggested something. I'm sorry, John, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
And they were talking about this this sort of thing as almost a shameful point, but I actually thought it was a rather unique way to do it. And they referenced, you know, Hunt for Red October, where you start off with them speaking Russian, and then all of a sudden the camera angle flips and they switch to English, and they're in English on that side from the rest of the thing. And I always thought that was a really great thing, because being able to speak in that language is at least the language you're used to hearing, helps you connect with the characters, which is what I thought every story wants to do, whether in a good way or a bad way. You want to connect.
You kind of anticipated what I was going to say, actually, because that's exactly what I was going to say, was that I would have expected them, and I was expecting them, to start in Klingon and then just flip back to English once you kind of introduced everybody to the idea that, okay, they're speaking in Klingon. We're just doing this for the purposes of increasing the watchability and the understanding. I mean, like you said, even if you're a Star Trek fan, it's like, if you're not, and you're looking at this because this is, you know, being billed as, oh, this is not your dad's Star Trek or something like that. And it's like, okay, let's give this a shot. And then it starts off with this long Klingon scene in subtitles. Like you said, if they're looking for something to really convince people that don't usually watch Star Trek to get involved with this... That's not the way to do it. They're really going to leave people out on a limb with that one.
Well, I have to ask, John, and I think it's a legitimate question. Is that who they're really just targeting? With this all access, it's a pay to watch it. So you're not going to catch a generic at this point, other than seeing him in what I feel to be half an episode. You're not going to catch a generic person that's going to fork out, was it between $5 if you want to watch commercials while you're paying, or $12 or $13 if you want to give commercial free, and and say, oh, I'm going to pay $13 to give to see the second half of the story or give this show a try. An average person is not going to do that. So as we talk about all the fan service that they were slapping into this thing, I have to say I don't think they're even trying to get a new audience. I think that all they're trying to do is go after the Star Trek people. And if they can get a million Star Trek fans paying $7 a month, $7 million a month, you know, that'll, and that's just in the USA, they might be able to, you know, it might be profitable for them. Is it going to ever see 3 to 4 million viewers? Maybe not. maybe they don't care. I you know, that this whole new model that they're introducing to some extent is maybe what they're going after. And, you know, they see the success of, you know, Game of Thrones and, you know, some other, you know, sort of paywall type of products and think that, oh, hey, you know, here's our chance to get in on it.
And you know what? Just like with Game of Thrones, your
genre
savvy audience is going to find other ways to get it.
Especially a Star Trek audience.
Yes, especially a Star Trek one, by all means. But I mean, okay, so sticking again to kind of the story stuff, I felt like they kind of went a very obtuse way with the Klingons that kind of took me a little while to get into, even though I am, in fact, I mean, I just read over the summer an entire trilogy that was deep into the nuances of Klingon society. I'm a fan. I still felt like this was a bit obtuse and out of left field, and it didn't quite track for me. I'll leave alone the visuals. As far as did the visuals line up, the visuals are never going to line up. I mean, you're going to have to really come up with something weird in order to say that they went from Enterprise to original series. Okay, we can all do that in our own headcanon if we need to. I chalk up the visuals to the fact that, you know, this is a representation of what happened in that point in history, and I just leave it alone. But the events that are taking place don't quite track to me. And one of the things that really was kind of I'm struggling with is the depiction of Sarek.
Let's see. Do you want to go with the hologram who Sisko talked when they were? This was a new technology on Deep Space Nine, 90 years later. Or do you want to talk about how he seems to rather embrace Michael's entry into Starfleet when he's currently hasn't been speaking to his son for 6 years as of current continuity because the son entered Starfleet?
Well, there would be all of that. That and the fact that he doesn't act or sound anything like Sarek. Even less so than Ben Cross in the Kelvin timeline. That there are moments where James Frayne is just way too emotional.
Yes.
With someone that is, like you said, embarking on the same journey that his estranged son is on.
That he condemned.
Yes.
Yes.
It just... Yeah. There's just something about his character here that does not track for me at all.
I also love the instantaneous communication that is now decided that it's just, oh, that, well, that's just because, you know, it's modern now. I don't think so.
These are all points that I understand, and there are certain, you know, well, let's put it this way. It's awfully forgivable when you have, say, the Babylon 5 context of this is actually a media representation of what was going on. But I'm fairly sure that they wouldn't have ignored certain obvious things about someone like Sarek. Just saying. They can dramatize the Klingons because not much was known about the Klingons at the time, and they can just, you know, make them, you know, arch villains to a certain degree. But yeah, there's just something about Sarek that just I cringe a little bit as I'm watching it, which is sad because Sarek is actually one of my, you know, favorite Vulcan characters, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's a favorite for many, but now what did you think of the second episode?
Well, we got our obligatory fight scene, which was, you know, much more along the lines of a Deep Space Nine fight scene where, yes, I guess where it is sort of, you know, modern special effects allow us to show a scene in a way that obviously the original series never could or could show us. So I was intrigued by that. I thought it, as a fight scene, it worked for me pretty well. I enjoyed the whole half blown out cell that Michael found herself in, as well as I found the, what did they call it, the ethical protocols? Yes. Very, very intriguing. I really like that bit of writing, and how even in a cell, because death is apparent, that the computer will allow overrides to some extent. Although I think she had to argue it a little bit harder than I think she should have had to. that was a little over dramatic. But that being said, the whole concept was thrilling to me. I really enjoyed that a lot, and the AI implications of such a thing is definitely needs much more pondering, because I thought it was a great thing. So that being said, the whole idea to to have this, have a fight on this scale to bring it past the two ships, I didn't quite get the need for it. I would have preferred it to be a much more personal type of story rather than bringing fleets this early in the show. Also, the idea that a long range ship in the middle of nowhere could call up another 8 to 10 ships immediately seems a little odd to me. And so, again, another sort of disbelief thing. If one or two had showed up, possibly, but I think they had another like 6 or 7, possibly even the Discovery, or at least a ship like that. But, you know, that just struck me as a little unbelievable. Really, that ship should have just been massacred. I originally assumed she was going to be a sole survivor kind of story rather than have it backed up and save the way it was. So that the death already of the dynamic character seemed a waste. We've barely known this guy. He's trying to rally everyone, and he gets killed off already. I understand the idea of a martyr character, but at this point, I don't know enough about him to make the martyring reverberate with me. So that was sad as well. The whole concept of them going on the ship with just two people seemed ridiculous. It was just a lot of scratching my head. Why are they writing it this way? Why do they feel the need to do this? It just concerned me to no end. You know, later on when the Klingons are actually a known entity, I could see them we've seen, us Starfleet personnel go in one or two, sneak in to do something. But at this point, they're such complete unknowns. I can't imagine why they would take the risk. And I guess we got the old, haha, the captain, captain goes over, and they finally showed us why the captain should not go over. it just lacked any common sense to me. So I just couldn't grasp why they felt the need to do this. Yes, it was an intense drama leading to one heck of a death scene for the captain. And I gave spoilers to everybody, so I don't want to hear it. And so it just seemed pointless. Except to, I guess, alienate and isolate Michael so that she's holding this sort of, not a chip on her shoulder, but this sort of weight on her soul for having not done something differently. And she already seems screwed up already. I didn't really think she needed that extra burden on top of her, but I guess they really want to push her down, down, down. Hopefully, I guess, to raise her up again, but they're really, they just keep dropping her. So that's another thing for the main character so low at the early point of the series seems a bit of an odd choice in plot.
Yeah, it really does. I felt like they overdid that quite a bit, actually, that you could have had her maybe even experience a quarter of what she did in terms of the survivor's guilt and everything else in order to give her the kind of redemption story that I think they're trying to set up. I think they just, the whole thing was a little overwrought in the end. I get that they were trying to have each side lose somebody significant to the audience in order to kind of show that this was a pivotal moment. Without actually putting your finger on exactly what moment that was, which they didn't, so we don't know if it is supposed to be anything related to Axon R, for instance.
Yeah,
that's right. I took that bullet. I just think that it was written a little bit oddly. I think that if it was meant to be, you could have had that be a different kind of standoff, and it still work. I personally would have liked to have seen it be just two ships against each other for the longest time without the reinforcements show up. And the reinforcements showing up being kind of the obvious, and maybe that's why they chose not to go that way, but I mean, it would have been the obvious way to defuse things was to have that be the battle happening while each side was waiting for reinforcements, and maybe have, Starfleet show up first. Or however you wanted to do it, but I would have liked to have seen more of, dare I say the word, a cerebral confrontation take place. Because this was too on the nose to have led to the Cold War that is going on. Like, this, by all logic of a Klingon story, should have led to a freaking war, a major one. And it doesn't seem to make sense why it fizzled out the way that it did. That's why I say it almost would have made more sense if it was two ships that wound up fighting at each other, and then they kind of, you know, squared off against each other, you know, across bridge, across the view screens, and sparred a little bit, and then backed off because clearly that it was not the time or the place. But yeah, it just kind of overplayed it in a certain degree, is the way that I felt. I was like, boy, they're really going for big stakes here. But in the end, the only stakes really fall on Michael, and it's overplayed. It's like overdone. It's quite frankly, she shouldn't have a future. So why, you know, why does it play out the way that it does? It's really hard to kind of follow the logic there. So I think I agree that while it's great to see more Trek on TV and everything else, and I'm certainly going to keep up with it, it does have its problematic aspects to it. And when we're not trying to bash it or anything like that, but these are areas that I would hope that as they go along, they improve. And the other thing is that this very much felt like this was the kickoff movie. Because I didn't actually see it in, you know, like one on TV and then one on the streaming service. I watched one right after the other.
It wasn't two separate episodes, and I think they really did themselves a disservice because the second one was so different in tone that it would have really if the first half didn't draw in an audience, the second half might have drawn in a different type of audience, and to limit themselves already more, even more so than their distribution method is doing, just seemed to be a poor decision. That the second half was so much more, you know, for the action-packed people and really sort of a much harder, even harder drama than the first half was, that, you know, it would have appealed, I think, to more people, and they botched it.
Yeah, I think that's the easiest way to put it, is that it was a swing and a miss as far as a pilot goes. Now, granted, I'll say it's a fair pilot, but what really strikes me as weird is that it's very obvious from the coming attractions that they showed that there's a huge disconnect between the first two episodes and what comes next. It's not like it flows right into it. They almost are going to have a new pilot for the third episode to really tell you the next phase of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So this feels so disconnected from everything. It feels just like a proof of concept movie. So I think that when you said earlier, you know, oh, the film, yeah, this does feel like a film. It almost feels like now we're going to see the TV series that comes after the film. It's a call to arms to Crusade for Babylon 5 fans out there.
Yeah, because, I mean, at this point when I haven't seen the next episode as we're recording this, but, you know, we're going to have a new captain, a new ship. She's been demoted and done, I guess, in whatever the equivalent of Starfleet prison is. But when she's pulled out of it. So, yeah, we're pretty much, you know, this was nice and all, but it really isn't the show that we're going to be seeing going forward.
Yeah, so it was very odd in that sense. Edmund gave this one an average rating, and I'll just read what he has to say here. Split decision here, 6 for part 1, 8 for part 2. Was very unimpressed by the broadcast half. The new Klingons were too slow and labored, wrestling the words past their prosthetics. There's your point, Mary.
Yeah.
Too much emphasis on the effects and the shiny, not enough on establishing the characters and relationships. The complaints about this ship and crew not matching with the supposed contemporary Pike mission in the cage and looking more like Kelvin Trek, I'll give them a pass on. You're not going to get a series made with 60s nostalgia protection values. The mutiny at the end did feel like contemporary edginess being injected into the cozy confines of the Federation. And then the cliffhanger and the final bludgeoning plea for CBS All Access, which were ubiquitous even while fast-forwarding through the DVR recording. After all that, I was not enthused. Then I watched part 2. No, I didn't subscribe. Let's just say I took a flight to Canada, which did get both parts before it disappears behind a paywall. And many of my objections were addressed. We got more backstory on both sides. There was seat-of-the-pants tactics in battle, a little classic TOS outlogic the computer action, an intriguing twist on Vulcan-human interactions with a human under Sarek's wing. And that mutiny? Oh yeah, she pays for it. In fact, it's the driver for this first season. All in all, a lot of the elements I hoped for from a Brian Fuller-driven Trek story gelled in that second half. And yes, I'll call it a half. CBS's biggest misstep was splitting this and playing their cutesy, sorry, you have to pay to see the end games. This was the prologue, the TV movie to introduce the series proper. Play the whole thing as a special Sunday night event, after 60 minutes, of course, and that full story with the season preview following was more than enough to push All Access sales and save themselves a lot of grief, criticism, and aggro. It was certainly enough to make me reconsider my disdain after part 1. So I think that he's echoing a lot of what we're saying here. And in fact, I think I agree when it comes to the whole All Access thing. They would have been much better served to show the whole thing. Then yeah. show the All Access thing. And say, if you want to see more, go to All Access. Doing it in the middle was just so crass. And any last words about the All Access thing? While we are on the topic.
Well, you know, we've on this show, we've been discussing how the viewing methods are changing, the networks, the cable systems. Now we're moving into an entirely online domain type of situation coming up. And, there's the tug between everybody wanting everything for free and the corporations wanting to make money from what they show. And I don't know, that there's ever necessarily a perfect medium. We talk about DVRing things to miss the very commercials that fund the shows that we want to see. And so there's always this tug back and forth. And I won't say I'm angry that CBS is doing this. I think they're trying to open up a new market for themselves. And much as when UPN went on the line and they used Voyager as the big wedge to have people come in on that new network, they're doing the same thing with another Star Trek show now with Discovery, trying to get people into this new network, if you want to use that term. And I don't have a problem with it, but it just seems to me that they're keep dancing around it. They don't want to admit that they're charging money for it to some extent. Oh, catch it on CBS, All Access. Like, you can do it without signing up and giving them a credit card or something like that. I think they need to be more honest with the people about it. They need to align themselves. They need to almost consider themselves an HBO, not a network with a pay-per-view service. And I really think they're spinning. They haven't even bothered to spin this in any way to even try and make it positive. They've just sort of ignored it. And I think people's perception might be a little bit different if they portrayed it in a different manner than the no manner that I feel that they're doing it with. So I don't mind it. I don't fault people for subscribing to the service. The rumor is that supposedly all Star Trek will be gone off every other viewing platform within the next 1 to 2 years as contracts end. So if you want to watch back Star Trek, you might end up buying access just because you'll get every series anytime you want it, and that's going to be the only place to get it online. So when you say, oh, wow, would I pay $7 a month to watch seven different series anytime I want? Yeah, maybe I would.
And that's not all that different than what the BBC did by pulling Doctor Who from everywhere else and putting it on BritBox and charging for it. It's the same exact thing. Is it annoying? Absolutely. But that's the way it works these days. So, you kind of...
Well, everybody complained for their a la carte service, and you're going to get it.
Yep, that's what we're dealing with. And you know what? They know or have to know that they're dealing with the inevitable, which is it's not going to be, a show that everybody is going to end up paying for. There's going to be people who are going to find their ways around it, and that's just the way it works now. That's the world that they live in. I'm curious what the ratings are like and what the numbers are like. Certainly, we already know that a second season is commissioned. But what about beyond that? I'm curious. But we'll have to wait a little while longer. I don't know that we'll ever get numbers. But I do wonder what the ratings were for Sunday.
There always is some sort of bragging rights, so hopefully if the numbers are worth... bragging about, that we will hear about them. And if we don't, I think that's sort of indicative in and of itself. So
maybe so.
I'm told these original episodes are costing somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 million an episode.
Ooh, yeah.
So I imagine perhaps that's accounting for sets and things like that, where come season one, that number drops substantially, at least reasonably per episode. So, if they're getting... Say you get 1 million people, and they're paying somewhere around $5 a piece. So that's $5 million a month, and that's not including international. So maybe they could make it work with just the single show.
Hmm. It's possible.
So, well, and, you know, we're just talking about Star Trek, but, you know, there's the Good Wife spinoff that's on CBS All Access that probably garners some visitors. As I said, once they move Star Trek's catalog over to All Access, that's an incentive in and of itself as well. So, you know, that's something to consider as they, you know, and if CBS continues to either produce new shows or move other shows over to this platform, you know, they'll probably will get an upswing. And we talk about this being the future. Maybe they're just the first network that's really taking all the lumps to see it actually, you know, to make it there.
Well, I will say this much. According to the information here, the CBS broadcast of the first episode was watched by 9.5 million viewers, which
domestically, right?
Domestically.
Yeah.
While that is much lower than what was the number for 90s Trek, that's again just the broadcast. It is said here, however, that the premiere of the series led to record subscriptions for the All Access platform, with the service having its biggest day of signups as well as its biggest week and month of signups, thanks to the series.
Well, that's why they created the whole thing.
Yes. Exactly. So, all that we are sitting back and kind of giving them a bit of an attitude about it, it seems to be working out for them. So, at least
when you start at zero, amazing numbers isn't always the amazing.
Well, they didn't have zero though. I mean, they had people who were already subscribed because of the Good Fight and other things that were on there, and we know that those numbers were pretty good because they did, as you said, kind of crow about them. So, yeah, I guess we'll find out. We'll find out. Something to keep an eye on, I guess you could say. All right, any other last thoughts on the premiere of Discovery before we sign off?
The uniforms are growing on me. When I first saw them, I wasn't that thrilled with them, but they actually look pretty sharp in action. So, while I can't imagine having to make one as cosplay, and I feel pity for anyone who is already doing that, they are very visually appealing, especially during action scenes. So,
I'm sure that Innovos will have them available very quickly, and
they
it will take approximately 17.9 years for them to show up in anybody's door.
Is that Earth years or Vulcan? I'm not quite sure.
Drazi.
Don't even get me started. Green. Go. Okay.
You're not Earth Day, Earth Year. Yes. Anyway. All right. We are done then talking right now about Star Trek Discovery, but you can be sure that we will be talking more about it in the weeks to come. And other shows as they spool out this week. We have a few shows that are, in fact, premiering. And I'm just going to throw some names out there while I have the app open that I use to keep track of all this. Obviously, the surprise second season of The Exorcist is back. The Inhumans starts up this week. We also have The Gifted coming, which is, of course, the show that is in the X-Men universe. And then that's it for this week. And then next week, we've got all kinds of things like Supergirl, The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, Riverdale, Mr. Robot, Supernatural, Arrow. And soon on the heels behind that is Star Wars Rebels in its final season and the next season of The Walking Dead. And by the time that we get to the end of this month, we see the second season of Stranger Things on Netflix.
Oh.
So there is a lot coming in the next few weeks and in this month of October.
My poor DVR doesn't know what's
going to
hit it.
That's right. So we are going to go ahead and sign off so we can rest up for what is looking like a good month. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under the Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.